This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Dave Brown, and this is a podcast version of AMI's Morning Show, Now with Dave Brown. Catch the live broadcasts weekdays from 9 to 11 a.m. Eastern on AMI Audio and AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. To say public transit is a crucial piece of infrastructure for people with disabilities would be an understatement, which only makes the design and inclusion component of public transit all the more important. Thea Curdy is an accessibility specialist and the president of Designable Environments. Hey, good morning, Thea.
Good morning, Dave. Did you have a good long weekend?
I had a pretty good long weekend. How about you?
It was good. A little cold. This is reminding me of spring in the 70s, but I'm aging myself.
These things happen. Hey, Thea, I want to start with a bit of a general question. All public spaces must require an incredible amount of consideration to ensure universality in the design. But I'm curious if the scale, sprawl, and variance of public transit generally creates an even more complex design challenge.
I'm so glad we're talking about public transit because, man, is there a lot of development happening across the country. Billions of dollars are being invested on expanding and improving, which in 2022, we're hoping includes fully integrated accessibility. And as advocates like to say, no money and certainly no government money should be spent on creating new barriers for disabled tourists and transit users. No one wants to invest in that kind of discrimination or limit revenue, considering 24% of our population have at least one type of disability, adding then, of course, all those with temporary or situational disabilities and the rest who benefit from accessibility accommodations. But as you know, I talk about the built environment aspects of transit experience, and that's not what makes up the full experience or accessible experience for public transit users, certainly. I also like to point out, as I've done frequently with you, that getting accessibility and universal design right is not rocket science. It's actually much smarter, more sustainable, more affordable, and there are opportunities for great new innovations. But to be successful, one of the most important things is to be consistent and predictable so that the more complicated your transit system is, the more the design team will need to be careful. Another important thing is consulting with disabled transit users, those with lived experience. And we're seeing a lot of this happening. The Nothing About Us Without Us approach from the Accessible Canada Act and requirements from other provincial legislation have increased the number and frequency of consultation meetings. In fact, Designable Environments has recently responded to market demand by providing a new service, creating alternative text descriptions for technical drawings just to service these meetings for the different accessibility requirements of people using. Traditional design has typically followed, unfortunately, a medical model of disability, where it's been up to the disabled person to figure out how to manage or access special needs services, and I'm using air quotes here. But really, there are services that people need. We have lots of articles demonstrating this, like a recent one I'll post on social media afterwards from the AARP, which really puts the onus on disabled people about how to use these facilities. And I don't think that's the right approach anymore.
Yeah, I think that's really well put, Thea, and it really lays the groundwork for us because, as you mentioned, different disabilities do require a particular best practice. And oftentimes that best practice is universally good for all users. And we'll get into a few specifics in a moment, but I wanted to share a quick anecdote about an experience that I had at a subway station recently. I was trying to find a particular bus stop at a station, and there really wasn't much signage inside the station or outside the station that could orient me towards that stop. And even if that stop itself had the bus number in the smallest, teensiest font, almost hidden behind the corner of a pillar, the question leads to a bit of an obvious point here, but how important is clear signage and what are some ways that public transit systems can relay that information in multiple formats?
I can relate to that story, Dave. I'm not blind, but I do now have several invisible disabilities, including some worsening vision loss as I'm getting older. But even when I was younger, and finding the right bus, especially in stations, as you said, has always been a problem or a challenge. Clear signage certainly is a part of what can make transportation easier and more usable, preserving dignity, showing respect, and reducing anxiety, frankly, for everybody. You're in a hurry, you're trying to find the right bus. You don't want to end up in the wrong place. Signage needs to be predictable and intuitive to really be effective. And there are many really cool and easy design ideas that we share with our clients. Here are seven to create more inclusive signage. One, ensure that the signage is, as I said, predictably placed across the system, not this way in this station and that way in that station. You're probably going to have to maybe every 5 years or so, maybe replace system-wide to make sure any new stations or renovations have caught up. Two, ensure signage is not just provided in large overhead format, although that's great and useful if you're looking over a crowd, but also in usable wall-mounted locations, which allows us to do our next item, number three, providing signage that has braille and tactile text that's reachable from a seated position or usable by shorter people or those who are nearsighted who can't obviously access the overhead signage. Four, using large print with mixed case, not all capitals. That means using capitals and small letters, which is more readable and easier for people, most people to read. Five, using large pictograms, which help those who are illiterate or can't speak English or French. And then the addition of things like QR codes or barcodes are also a popular idea that's starting to gain some traction. If you have a smartphone and access to the internet, this can give you a lot of great information or take you to websites. And then seven, providing tactile walking surface indicators with color contrast that lead to the signs. Vancouver introduced last year, they were adding Braille to bus stop signage as a trial to change their standards, which we hope catches on across the country.
Thea, what about for individuals who might have a mobility issue or mobility concern? You know, for example, it's Multiple Sclerosis Awareness Month. What design elements could be incorporated for people with mobility issues?
So transportation, we see many barriers for mobility device users, mistakes that are easy to prevent with some planning, but expensive or hard to impossible to fix after building without using accessibility and universal design in mind. This could be an election issue for many, as you pointed out, because public transit is the most affordable transportation for many, especially for seniors and disabled folks, to access things like their education, jobs, healthcare, visiting friends, and taking part in community events. Without accessible transit, people can be trapped at home. Design for mobility should include many things, including the following seven ideas, which are really simple. One, approach the entry of the building, platform, or dock if you're using a ferry as a part of transit. These need to be level and include at least one, if not two-way ramps, especially in busy locations where people are going to be getting on and off. You don't want the ramp to be plugged as you're trying to rush to the train or waiting for somebody to come up the ramp as you're trying to leave to catch a bus. Entrances should need to have power door openers or have auto sliders to just get out of the way. And if they're auto sliders, you don't have to find the button. The clear width for the doors is number three. Four paths and level spaces at the ticket counters, pay machines, or verification counters. Five, providing rest area benches for those who experience fatigue or have stamina issues. Six, make sure you have two elevators. When you're providing elevators for multiple levels, make sure there are always two, because if one has to be closed down for maintenance or inevitably one of them will break, the minute that happens, that station is not accessible. And then finally, seven, designers need to understand that tactile directional paths, which we didn't get a chance to talk about yet in detail, could be quite painful for people with mobility devices. So while they provide independence and dignity and safety for those who are blind, the bumpity bump passing them could become a problem. So you want to make sure that they're in the right place, but not so prolific they limit access for others.
Thea, that's my mistake. Let's go back to those tactile paths for navigation. What can people do to ensure those are well designed and to be inclusive?
So for those who are using white canes, these are especially helpful as they provide a high color contrast tactile path surface on the ground or on the interior flooring. But they're also useful for sighted people as well. There are two specific types of walking surface indicators that are referred to by the initials TWSI or tactile attention that include tactile attention indicators and tactile directional indicators. The type people are most familiar with, perhaps, are the round raised domes that are arranged in rows. In transit, you find them along the edge of the subway or light rail platforms to warn people of a drop off so that people don't fall onto tracks. We also see these in cities and curb cuts to warn people that they're leaving the sidewalk and passing into the street at the crosswalk or at the top of stairs to make sure people don't fall. But in addition, we also see them used as a warning or meaning to pay attention. So they can be used on the ground underneath signage on the wall. How does a blind person find Braille signage? They're not going to be dragging their arms along the walls right, trying to find things. But if you put a tactile attention indicator on the ground, some people are using this as a way to help people find. They're also used in a different type of path called a tactile wayfinding path. And these use tactile directional indicators, or TDIs, which are several long raised bars arranged parallel to each other that create a basically follow me kind of path, especially where there are large open spaces like outdoor plazas, building lobbies, or in transit to the entrance and other important points needed for the traveler.
Thea, what about for members of the deaf and hard of hearing community? How can public transit be made more inclusive for them?
Transit is often a really loud place to be. Buses are running, or at least they, until we get electric buses. Trains are rushing into and out of station. There's all the dings and dongs and overhead announcements. And of course, all of the noise from the transit users and staff. And when we think about the accommodations for those who are deaf, deafened, and hard of hearing, some just make the environment far more usable and comfortable for everyone. So like good acoustics, creating quieter environments that not only allow us to hear things more clearly, like the overhead announcements or conversations with our customer service person or somebody that we're talking with over the intercom, quieter environments are much less stressful or scary for both people and service animals that people are using. Many designers are not aware that people with vision loss or those who are blind are often using acoustic cues as a part of their wayfinding strategies. So quieter environments are great too. Then there's providing assistive listening systems like hearing loops and volume controls at customer service desks, in elevators or passenger assistance intercoms, and at bus stops or platforms at designated waiting areas to hear the overhead announcements.
Thea, something I'd never considered before was the impact for individuals experiencing multiple chemical sensitivities as they're going through public transit. What can be done to consider the needs of folks from this community?
We're focusing a lot on this because it is Multiple Chemical Sensitivities Awareness Month. So if you've been following us on social media, you've seen the DE and myself have been posting a lot of really good information and resources out there about all kinds of design. But multiple chemical sensitivities is basically the more severe version of a category of invisible disabilities called environmental disabilities or sensitivities called ES. ES includes infants, small children, people who are sensitive to chemicals and smells, people who have allergies fall into this category, people who get migraines from perfumes or strong scents, and people who receive cancer treatments can feel nauseous, exposed to some of these everyday kinds of experiences. Those with multiple chemical sensitivities, or MCS, may find even small amounts of these types of exposures toxic to the point of experiencing dizziness, nausea, headaches, brain fog, or even fatigue. So we want to make sure that design is usable and doesn't create a barrier to use for access to healthcare and all of these other things that people need. So we need to pay special attention to the materials we're choosing for flooring, paint, glues and adhesives that are used, and we want something called no volatile organic compound, or VOC, materials. So if you're familiar with VOCs, even if you don't know it, it's that fresh paint smell that you might get from traditional paint in a room, or that new car smell that we're all familiar with. That can be very toxic, but so can somebody's perfume or even their laundry detergent. So we have a much bigger issue. So if you're going to be installing things, you want to make sure to allow for what's called off-gassing. You need to buy it and put it outside and let it vent away to get rid of some of those chemical smells. It's also a part of the maintenance. You want to make sure you're not using cleaning products that are really stinky. They have a low, no scent products that can be used. And of course, adopting fragrance-free environmental policies, which we sometimes see in hospitals and increasingly businesses and workplaces, but where that fails because people are going to show up not realizing they should have done that, making sure that you have great ventilation and filtration of your air systems is critical.
Thea, I started this with something of a frustrating experience that I had, but I was wondering if I might be able to bounce a couple of really positive experiences that I've had over the years on public transit as someone who uses it exclusively. And I should acknowledge that none of these systems are perfect and probably present their own design shortcomings, but I want to mention them. One that I love is the audible bus stop announcements inside a bus. The first time I experienced that one was when I moved to Ottawa in 2009. It really gives you a sense of, you know, when you're departing and stopping to get at a place. I really enjoy that. My one caveat is that I sometimes wish the announcement was a bit louder or a bit clearer. Something else Ottawa did on their main bus fleet, huge font on the front and side of the bus in terms of the bus number and which way it's heading. I wish more buses would also have that external announcement via an external speaker. I know it's becoming more common, but I wish it was universal. Something they do in Montreal in their metro system that is clearly label their lines with a color coding. So when you get to a station like Barrie UQAM, where three different lines connect, it's super obvious what color line you are navigating towards and which direction you're going. It's not just that the signs are clear. There are tons of them, so you're perpetually offered a reminder. Now, once again, the caveat being is I imagine for folks who are colorblind or totally blind, those signs would not be helpful. But to me, as a legally blind person, really, really amazing stuff. And something they do in Vancouver with their SkyTrain stations, where there are multiple lines going through a single stop, they'll identify which trains are coming on boards located all over the platform, and they'll have an audible announcement before the train fully pulls in. I always liked how that gave me a bit of peace of mind when sometimes I was a teensy bit overwhelmed by which way I was going. So it took away some anxiety as I was doing that. So sorry, Thea, that was a bit of a long rant, and I don't necessarily have a specific question, but any reaction to those experiences that I mentioned?
Indeed, I do. Those are all things I've noticed in my travels. Audible bus stop announcements are great if they're accompanied by large, easy-to-read text on screens. And of course, providing assisted listening, like hearing loops, which broadcast directly to somebody's hearing aid, are fantastic accommodations. In fact, in Auckland, New Zealand, bus stops not only had overhead screens showing what buses were coming and when they were going to be arriving, they also had an on-demand button at the bus or just below the bus stop sign where people could push and have the next bus announced on a speaker. So you didn't have to wait for it. You could get it on demand, which I thought was fantastic. Your next story about visibility of buses and streetcars is indeed a great idea. Large displays that are high color contrast are great. In Mississauga, they've actually added on their buses that the number is shown on the back of the bus too, which is great if I'm coming up from behind and need to run for the bus. And then, of course, mapping, which is clear and easy to use, but using color, as you said, as a part of the map, and then maybe even integrating that color as a part of the wayfinding in the station, lines that you can follow on the wall or other strategies we've seen. That what we have to be careful about with mapping is that there's been a trend towards kiosks. And unfortunately, while kiosks are cool because it's a large screen, many times touching, and can change the display, which can give lots more information than a static sign can, our legislation has been failing us. And frankly, our design education for industrial design and programming have not been teaching our students how to create kiosks that are fully accessible and integrate accessibility accommodations for all kinds of users. These kiosks, when they're replacing signage and maps, can actually become a significant barrier for people with disabilities. And announcing what train is coming next or arriving is great if you can hear. So as we said, displays, screens are shown everywhere around. Wouldn't it be great if there was a live update to your website or if an app can have a great addition to tell you that information as well? Or if you can have scrolling text on these screens that show the same information as being announced. Easy to do accommodations.
Thea, we've kept you way over time, way longer than scheduled today. So we're going to skip the emergency preparedness question. Maybe that's something we can revisit in a future segment. But before we let you go, any upcoming events that you want to put on our radar?
Thanks, Dave. Yes, next week is National Accessibility Awareness Week, or NAAW. I'm really excited to have been invited to the first Canadian Congress on Disability and Inclusion, which kicks off May 26th and 27th. I'm going to be appearing on the main stage on May 27th, just before 11 o'clock. And that this will be a panel discussion on built environment, addressing myths and excuses of cost, the cost to include versus the cost to exclude. And they'll be posting on social media with hashtag innovative together. Also for National Accessibility Week, AMI is sponsoring a 3 free event, 1 day of an encouraging thing for the Experiences Expo, the Visionaries Forum, and the 2022 Visionaries Community, starting at 11 a.m. at the Miles Nadal JCC on Spadina Avenue. Then in June, I have 2 events coming up, which I'll be posting about on social media, which I won't go into now because we've run long. But please follow me on social media at T Curdy, TKURDI, or at Tweet Design. Designable on Twitter, or if you prefer, we're also on Facebook and LinkedIn.
Right on. Yeah, Thea, we're going to be talking about the Canadian Congress on Disability in the next hour of the show with one of the organizers. So we're thrilled to do a follow-up on that one. Thea, thank you so much for taking some extra time for us today. We're grateful. Have a wonderful day, and we'll talk to you again in a couple weeks.
Terrific, Dave. Talk to you soon.
You've been listening to Now with Dave Brown. Hit the subscribe button on any podcast platform and leave us a rating and a review.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.